on Flashpoints, we'll take an in-depth look at the huge nuclear weapons buildup by the Obama administration as they continue to break the law and turn their back on legally binding nuclear non-proliferation treaties. And we'll feature an extended interview with 86-year-old Sister Megan Rice, who just served 2 years behind bars for breaking into a nuclear weapons facility in Oak Ridge and pouring her own blood on nuclear warheads. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention today to the White House Nuclear Security Summit and the administration's support for what appears to be a massive buildup of a 21st century nuclear weapons arsenal. The Obama administration's focus on nuclear security is part of a so-called comprehensive nuclear policy presented by the president in Prague in 2009. In that speech, President Obama described a four-pronged agenda to pursue a world without nuclear weapons. That's what he said. He laid out new U.S. policies and initiatives toward nuclear disarmament, nuclear non-proliferation, nuclear security, and nuclear energy. Well, again, we're going to devote most of today's show to a deep examination of the nuclear weapons buildup that is championed by President Obama in the name somehow of arms reduction. It's hard to sort of see that. We'll evaluate some of the clear and present dangers of the policy. And later on, you're going to hear from an 86-year-old peace activist, a nun who has devoted her life to resisting this expanding nuclear weapons policy. Well, it is good to have you with us. Joining to talk about this is Greg Mello. He's been on top of this for some time. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and he's a leading expert on nuclear weapons. Greg Mello, thanks for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
Well, let's begin with, what is this nuclear security summit? What is it billed to be? Help us understand what we're being told about that.
Yes. It's being billed as a kind of capstone of the Obama administration's non-proliferation and nuclear security efforts, more so in the area of nuclear terrorism and trying to corral loose nuclear material. There are something like 50 heads of state in town, and the White House will unveil, I haven't checked to see whether any of this has appeared yet, commitments that countries are expected to make, and they are trying to create some momentum going forward. I mean, that's the story, at least.
Now, you describe it as the summit as a spectacle designed to enhance the status and power of the United States, using nuclear security as an issue or a foil. Now, you tell us what you mean by spectacle. Those are pretty strong words. Is that hyperbole, or what is this that you mean?
Well, the real work of nuclear security takes place bit by bit. I think Laura Holgate, the White House person on this, used the phrase of the success of incremental progress, I think is the phrase she used. That's a good phrase. It's accurate. Although it's basically 2 days is not enough to accomplish anything. It'll be long on pomp and short on substance. The administration has brought so much baggage to the table, and there are so many contradictions that won't be discussed, that it's not a kind of open, frank discussion of all the issues. The issues are framed within the foreign policy agenda of the United States. So Iran is a potential proliferation problem, but Brazil is not, even though both enrich uranium. South Africa is somewhat intermediate. They insist on their right to, which I think is correct under law, to enrich uranium to whatever percent they want. So the application of these principles is, you know, it varies depending on when you're, whether you're an ally of the United States or not. And the way that these ideas are applied to states depends on what kind of commercial deals are on the table and where the country sits in U.S. geopolitical ambitions.
Now, do you describe what's going on in terms of U.S. plans, U.S. nuclear plans? Do you see this as a part of disarmament, or is this a dangerous buildup creating a new generation of weapons that generals sort of appear a little bit more willing to use?
Well, all those issues are very specifically off the table in this discussion. So some of the greatest nuclear security dangers won't come up. Most of the nuclear weapons in the world are held by the United States and Russia. The Obama administration has so severely alienated Russia that they aren't coming. They were not allowed to take part in any of the preliminary drafting of documents, and basically they feel like they're, if they, I read the, what spokespersons in Russia have said, and reading between the lines, why should we go when our role is to get kicked around once we're over there? So, and the Obama administration hasn't been cooperative, and we disagree on major issues. So, until we start, you know, talking privately, let's not talk publicly. So, you know, I'm kind of sympathetic with that.
What do we know about, again, that question of, are we in the middle of a major buildup?
Yes, I left that on the table. I'm sorry. Yes, we certainly are. The greatest buildup since Reagan. The Obama administration has launched a modernization plan for every U.S. nuclear weapons system, and it was expected to cost in excess of $1 trillion. We just learned this week that in an excellent column by Kingston Reef at the Arms Control Association, that the default plan of the Air Force for ICBMs is now to have mobile ICBMs, a plan that was rejected after considerable protest during the Reagan administration. But now that is the Obama administration plan. More than $1 trillion in modernization and operational costs ahead of us over the next 30 years, as one administration official said to us in February, I feel like I've been a complete failure. I went to work for the Global Zero president, and he's leaving office having started the greatest arms race in a generation.
Now, yeah, and again, this is incredibly important because of the state of the world and the touchstones you pointed out in terms of conflicts in the Ukraine and Syria. So, and you, the reason I'm delighted to have you with us, Greg Mello, working as the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, you have done a detailed review. That's why I asked you to set aside the hyperbole. I want to hear more about the specifics of the weapons buildups, why you're so sure this is a buildup. I want people to be clear that Barack Obama is doing this. And it's just say more about the details, because you've done the work there.
Sure. Well, so the present generation of submarines is to be replaced by another generation of submarines.
Nuclear submarines.
Nuclear submarines that will launch ballistic missiles. The new submarines will be at least as capable as the ones that came before. The missiles are, for now, the same missiles. The warheads are being upgraded, and you can imagine, if you will, the electronic evolution that has taken place from the 70s and the 80s until today. So now you can have radar and fusing and celestial navigation improvements on these warheads that improve their accuracy to the point where, as MIT scientist emeritus Ted Postol puts it in kind of a rough manner, the one of the new warheads is worth about two of the old warheads in terms of attacking hard targets. They're much more accurate. Now, moving on, the ICBMs have been gradually upgraded all along, and as I mentioned, now the plan is to replace the whole works with mobile ICBMs. The gravity bombs, one large gravity bomb is being retired. The others are being consolidated into a very capable, highly accurate, multi-yield warhead with some earth-penetrating capability and yields that go down just to, accuracy that goes down to 30 meters. They will be delivered by stealth fighter bombers, such as F-35, which adds another dimension to this weapon system. The basing is forward compared to what it was before. So all in all, we've got a more capable weapon system there. Probably the most destabilizing of the lot is the proposal to build more than 1,000 nuclear-tipped stealthy cruise missiles. These aren't counted under the New START treaty or any treaty, because that treaty just counts a bomber as one single nuclear weapon, no matter how many cruise missiles or bombs it carries. So, in essence, this is kind of a breakout weapon for the United States. It is extremely expensive, which is to say impossible to defend against. Very stealthy cruise missiles, the Pentagon is delighted that this will impose enormous costs on Russia and China. I'm, as you can imagine, greatly less delighted. So these are some of the concrete, I should mention the construction of warhead factories. The United States has a aging nuclear warhead infrastructure, and so there is a debate, which we've been a part of, as to what should be the capacity for producing new warheads. And tens of billions of dollars are earmarked for building factories here in New Mexico and in Oak Ridge, which we oppose.
Now, these buildups, this expansion of and 21st century buildup really goes along with what Reagan started out in terms of this concept of full dominance from air, land, sea, space. And we see this, if I've got this right, and please help me understand it, in the geopolitical sense, this goes along with what we now know is the U.S. Pacific pivot, to control, to sort of wrap a ring around China, to build huge bases, and to arm the countries. I guess Japan, the Japanese prime minister is in town now, I'm sure they're talking about this, to surround China and control what people are referring to next this century as the China century. You want to talk about that?
Sure. There's a way in which these nuclear weapons are conceived by military planners now as a way to control the escalation of conventional wars in Asia, either East Asia or in the Middle East, using nuclear weapons. So because electronics and advanced weaponry is proliferating and countries like China have very capable weapon systems, they become peer competitors of the United States in conventional weapons, especially in their near abroad. So the idea is that we can threaten adversaries with nuclear weapons and thus try to deter their denial of territory and deter a conventional stalemate or victory by the adversary, and thus we can have our way. This is so the nuclear weapons are being conceived as a kind of a top cover or escalation control during conventional wars.
And it is interesting that you have that the United States now has partners like the Japanese Prime Minister, who, to say as a right winger, is to put it mildly, who loves and never really saw a nuclear reactor he didn't love, and is really a prime partner for Japan to come into this 21st century nuclear operation, you know, standing side by side with, a Nobel laureate?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let me ask you this question. It's 2016. I guess we're about to just move into spring here, 2016. Where is the nuclear clock for you? Are we in more danger than we were in 2000?
Yes, I think we certainly are. And I'm not alone in this, you know. Gorbachev has written about it. Noam Chomsky is all the time talking about it. And the reasons are because we've lost track of some of the insights we had during the late Cold War, which is that other countries have legitimate security concerns as well as we do, that have to be respected, and it's in our interest to do that. What we see here and what we hear from colleagues in Washington who are in the position to have conversations we're not, is that that concept of allowing the sovereignty and allowing sovereignty, full sovereignty, to other countries and a legitimate suite of security concerns for them, this has become somewhat foreign to strategic thinking in the White House and in the Pentagon. Well, that's very dangerous. We can't control the world. And after the Cold War, we have somehow grown into the idea that we can. And that hubris is extremely dangerous. Another aspect of this is that we now have material interests in conflict that weren't in conflict during the Cold War. Russia had plenty of oil and gas, so did we. We could have, if we chose, developed separately and peacefully. Now cheap oil is scarce. There's expensive oil, but it breaks economies when you have to actually pay for it all. So we have there are pipeline routes which are being fought over in the Middle East now. So it's a completely different environment with more pointed concerns. And with climate change thrown in, then it gets worse.
And so finally, let's come back to the legal side of this. My understanding is the U.S. has an obligation to disarm under the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. This is a legitimate treaty with the United States, right? Could you talk about that? And I guess we're
sure.
Sort of lawbreakers here.
Sure, we are. And Article 6 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty says each of the parties to the treaty undertakes to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament, and on a treaty on general and complete disarmament under strict and effective international control, period. Well, that is a ratified treaty, which the State Department says is the most successful arms control treaty of all time. And it has been very successful. However, the treaty is on the rocks because the nuclear weapons states have done nothing visible to comply with this Article 6. They have reduced their arsenals largely for economic reasons, but they retain 7,000 weapons apiece in the case of the U.S. and Russia, which is more than enough to reduce the Earth to a freezing radioactive ruin.
A freezing radioactive ruin. Any chance of any kind of enforcement of these treaties?
Yes, there's an interesting side to this that escaped me certainly for years. That article says each of the parties to the treaty. It doesn't say just the nuclear weapon states. So recognizing that, the non-nuclear weapon states are to some extent rising up. And now we have two-thirds of the countries in the world have signed a pledge, pioneered by Austria, to pursue a prohibition on the very possession of nuclear weapons. Now, no one imagines that the nuclear weapon states will sign this, but a ban on nuclear weapons, the way cluster munitions and landmines are banned, would have a dramatic political effect, even in the United States.
Wow. If the United States, is there any momentum? Where is your hope on this front?
Sure. My hope is partly with this international movement, and it's partly with the reality that as you look at the Pentagon's modernization plans overall, including the giant nuclear weapons modernization, but the F-35, the Navy's ships, it's just way too much. And so we have a bow wave of all bow waves of spending lined up. And you could call it, as veteran analyst Chuck Spinney does, a time bomb in the Pentagon budget. Nobody can afford all this stuff, even if there aren't cost overruns. So the upshot is that, and the work that many of us have to do is to realize that what's at stake here is really the social contract of the United States. What is our identity as a country? Are we just a military, or do we care about our citizens? Do we care about our children?
In terms of number one dangers, ultimate dangers, is it ISIS putting together a dirty bomb? Where do you see the most dangerous possibilities for a real nuclear exchange or problem here?
So there's high consequence, low probability events, and then there's high probability, medium consequence of events. And I think that my biggest concern, I guess, is that we will just sleepwalk as a country to the point where we have so many unresolved hazards and risks and so many unpaid bills in terms of infrastructure, in terms of education and climate change, energy, not to mention the diplomatic work that we haven't really done, the maturation as a country we haven't really undertaken, that they all come due at once and we just fail in a major way. And then, you know, it's no telling where the real impact will come, whether from within or through some misadventure.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. It is a very worrisome situation, and it really isn't often talked about in the sense that it is a current and present danger, given all the hot spots in the world, given what's going on in the Ukraine and again in Syria with Russia and the United States and all the possibilities for terrible things to happen. To see and really not get the information from the corporate press in any real way that there is a huge nuclear buildup that Obama, the Peace Award winner, is not leading the charge for peace. It's disturbing, and I guess in terms of the candidates, it's not looking all that good, generally speaking. We're going to have to leave it right there. Greg Mello is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group and is a leading expert on nuclear weapons. By the way, leading expert, if people want to get more information, if they want to educate themselves, can they follow your work? What's your advice?
Sure. Go to our website, www.lasg.org. And there are some others, but we're out of time, so go to our website.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us on this very important subject. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Berkeley. I'm Dennis Fernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our discussion of, the resistance of nuclear weapons and trying to deal with the fact that the United States is really in the middle of a 21st century buildup. So we're going to continue that discussion in from a bit of a different angle. We're delighted and honored to be joined by Sister Megan Rice. Sister Rice is one of the Transform Now plowshares. She spent some serious amount of time in jail resisting this buildup, putting her body where her beliefs are. And Sister Megan Rice, it is really an honor to have you. I think we've spoken before. It is terrific to speak with you. Now, I want you to begin, if you would, by just reminding people what is the Transform Now plowshares, and how did you find yourself in federal prison?
Okay, Dennis. I happen to have been 9, 10, 11, 12, up to 15 years old when we knew that something next door to us, right near Columbia University, was going on, and a certain biological physicist who lived next door to us, Dr. Selig Hecht, was unable to tell his wife or his daughter what he was doing every day in the physics building at Columbia. And so I have this memory that goes back 70 years, you know, of something very evil evolving. Then I was also happened to be, by happenstance of birth, have an uncle, Walter Hook, who spent his time in the Pacific and was sent to Nagasaki slightly after the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs were dropped on Japan. And I was 15 years old at that time. And later, as I got to realize what my uncle had gone through, there was nothing for the Marines to do in their occupation of that part of Japan. He was able to tell us over the years of the devastation and the immorality and the illegality, the criminality of this whole nonstop, I would call it, addiction to continuing the gold rush, as J. Robert Oppenheimer called it, which was the nuclear weapons industrial complex. So I have no excuse not to be doing all I can to share that lived experience and my awareness and of the reality of these crimes against humanity, which continue till this day.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your initial conviction. You were allegedly intending, according to the government, to do harm to national security by entering the Y-12 National Security Complex, a nuclear weapons plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. What were you doing there? I think you spent about 2 years in jail.
Yeah, 25 months of a 35-month sentence. Well, I had also been educated. I spent most of my life in West Africa in the active years of teaching, and I came back in 2002 or 3 with in order to get well from some malaria. And then I was immediate. I knew that if I were in this country, I would have to be doing something to expose the lunacy and the illegality and criminality of nuclear weapons. So I had been associated with people who do that full time, namely the Jonah House community in Baltimore, started by Phil Berrigan and Liz McAllister back in the 80s, with the first action to demonstrate, to symbolically show the evil of the continuing production of nuclear weapons. So I was just part of that community of many peacemakers around the country, and a community which has evolved over 100 Plowshares actions to try to conduct direct action in order to bring about the transformation of our nuclear weapons industrial complex into that which is life enhancing, which could easily happen. I mean, it wouldn't be very easy, but it would certainly help to create the kind of economic system in this country, and certainly psychological attitudes in this country, to in favor of peace and harmony, remembering that violence can only beget violence, and that nonviolence can beget nonviolence in our world. So I was present at several trials where other people had done what we call plowshares actions. Should I just mention many people? That
sure.
would be a familiar term. Should I mention why we chose that?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just tell people, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Sister Megan Rice, who is 86 years old, spent a couple of years in jail, as you're hearing her tell the story, for an action that also included pouring blood and painting, quote, "The fruit of justice is peace." On, I guess you did this on weapons or on the wall. They say you were endangering national security. I would love you to continue with the story. And how would you characterize that? Do you think you were endangering national security?
We're doing exactly the opposite, because that which is endangering national and global security is the existence of even one nuclear weapon. At the amount of power that they now exist, up to 400 and more times the devastating power of either the Nagasaki or the Hiroshima bombs. That's an unbelievable, unimaginable amount of damage, and so I was just very aware of this situation. And when one is aware, one must oppose and expose a crime. And I was aware for many years, and having attended many trials under the federal judiciary system, trials of people who had engaged in exposing and opposing the criminality of the existence of nuclear weapons. And so I was, the last one for me was the Disarm Now Plowshares action, which took place in near the Bangor in Tacoma, Washington, where the Bangor Naval Base has Trident submarines.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were five activists, five people, namely Father Bill Bixel, a Jesuit priest who had engaged in a number of peaceful actions to demonstrate the evil of nuclear weapons and of the use of torture in this country, in its seeking intelligence, seeking, you know, information, like at the School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia. And also Sister Anne Montgomery, who had been one of the participants in the first Plowshares action in 1980, I believe it was, and King of Prussia, I believe, in a place where nuclear weapons were being made back then. And Lynn Greenwald, a grandmother and a practicing nurse, who, as well as Susan Crane. I think I've named five people. And they were able to enter an open base near Tacoma, Washington, near Puget Sound, and walk in the early hours of the morning, passing people on the road, and got themselves to where we know 2,000 nuclear bombs are stored. 2,000, close to what they say might be the U.S. arsenal of nuclear weapons now, although we know, anyway. So we were at their trial, which went on for more than a week, with excellent testimony and therefore much exposition of the criminality and the illegality of anything but nuclear disarmament under the treaties that have been signed by this country, going back to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1970 or 69, was it?
Yeah, and let me again jump in here. Sister Rice, yeah. I mean, it is extraordinary, the tradition that you represent, and when you talk about the work and the trial happening in Washington, mm-hmm. and your own work, and you remind us of the Berrigans, you really remind us that there is another way to act, and that there is this possibility of serious resistance in which you really do put yourselves on the line. I can tell you that I was in Connecticut to interview the Berrigans. I can't remember what Harrisburg Prison. I can't.
Right. Yeah, Pennsylvania.
You know, and I interviewed them coming and going, and the, you know, and the inspiration that came out of that. You know, I'd often hear from younger people, God, well, it's, we really, you know, want things to change, but like we did these three actions and nothing changed, you know, and so we're depressed now. And then you hear, then you see what you all are doing and what you're still doing at 86. And it's an extraordinary inspiration. It's I really
and
wish.
Hundreds of other people with me. I mean, we are certainly have a whole peace community around the world. We're very aware of that, having recently visited seven countries of Europe where young people were wanting to hear about the possibility of U.S. disarmament of nuclear weapons. But it is very much a generative theme in our world and has never stopped being. So it's extremely important for those who know the extreme urgency of dismantling and transforming the nuclear weapons complex into that which is for life and not for death. That's why we chose, having attended three or four other Plowshares trials in different parts of the country, especially this last one in 2010 into 11, it was. 2010 anyway. So from then on, I knew that it was necessary to do it again, because when one trial fails, then we have to try again, and the trials are only failing because people are in collusion, I believe, with the Pentagon and the warmongers who have sustained so secretly this industry, and at the cost of up to $10 trillion of U.S. taxpayers' hard-earned money over the last 70 years. And we also knew and kept aware of the fact that this modernization idea, which was posed in a way that was not, it was just the opposite of what it would be, that this would minimize the expenses because they would enlarge three or four facilities that already exist or move one away, which happened in Kansas City over the last 3 years, with a huge allocation of another $1 trillion. So we knew that before this expansion gets going, we need to perform another direct action so that the word would get out and the propaganda would leak.
And yes. Your work is, from my perspective, now more important than ever, because
yes.
we're seeing this face-off again mm-hmm. between nuclear powers around the Ukraine. We're seeing the possibility of sort of a bit of a shooting war in Syria between superpowers, and so it is a fragile moment. I think it's important to add that ultimately your charges were overturned after you served a couple of years, right?
Yes, because we had genuine appeals, federal appellate courts who looked at the action seriously and were scathing to the three judges, I guess, that vote for this. I'm not quite sure how that I wasn't at the place during the time, but in the federal district court, appeals court, was it the court? They just, overturned the lies that were stated by the prosecution, which our judge and jury went along with in Knoxville, Tennessee, which has benefited tremendously by its Oak Ridge, Tennessee, since 1943 engagement in the all of these appropriation and making use of the appropriations by the government and corporations who have the contracts. So it's been a profiteering, an incredible profiteering work. And one way that we can prove that is by actually going into the facility. And if a facility is doing illegal criminal activity, it's our duty to enter that facility and expose and oppose it. So we spent about a year discerning with various communities of people around the country, especially in places like Kansas City, Kansas. We knew people in Los Alamos, and we had an awareness of the communities and in Oak Ridge, living near Knoxville, Tennessee. So we consulted them and saw that actions would take place because of the added modernization program. We felt it very important that actions take place in 2012 to expose what was happening in those facilities and try to make people aware of this modernization that was going to go on. So we decided to act at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for its age and for the fact that no one had made a direct action there to expose the crimes of the federal government against international and constitutional law. So we were well conscientized, shall we say, by our information and our knowledge of the truth. So that was why we chose Oak Ridge, Tennessee, going back to 1943, nonstop production of highly enriched uranium. And the United States propaganda over the years about the production of highly enriched uranium, may being somewhere like in Iran or North Korea or wherever, whereas in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, there's enough highly enriched uranium fuel of which are needed for making every new high thermonuclear weapon, which is now in operation. Enough for 10,000 of those has already been produced. And every day as we speak, production goes on. So it's a humongous evil that we just don't know about, the world's best kept secret in some ways. So we
what did you do? Can I ask you? I mean, I remember talking with the Berrigans at different times about what happened inside jail and the kinds of relationships and the interactions. What was that important to you?
It was very important.
Could you talk about that, please?
Yes. I had already spent 2 6-month terms at Danbury. So I knew that when one is in a federal or any prison, the people who are there are so inspiring and so open, and they are the ones whose jobs had to be selling drugs because the economy is so war related and therefore job limited. It's not. And wartime is not meant to be world war time, so we shouldn't be having to make people help, engage in war-making activities in order to have food to put on the tables of their children. And so we were highly motivated, And your question again was what happened? Oh, so you have a wide open audience too. When you show respect to the other inmates and listen to their stories, they're very, very eager to find out why. And in my case, it happened to be a woman who is over 80 this time. So, so we related together and we prayed together and we reflected and we shared information together. And it was a very, privileged time for me, I would say. I never got into a prison, and that was also a good this time, because the prison system is a botched system. The federal, there are too many people, as we know, for the federal system and the state systems and the county systems. And some of them, I'm hoping right now, I have a friend who was 23 years in Danbury Prison, and I was sent to the Brooklyn facility, and I met this woman who had just come along with 60 other women who were a part of the 1,200 women who had been moved from Danbury Women's Federal Correctional Facility around the country, while 1,200 men had to be moved into Danbury, which had been previously the only one of the main women's federal prisons. So we moved into the Federal Correctionals Institution or Center facility in Brooklyn, where 60 women at the time from Danbury were being housed, and I was there for the next 13 months. And
That's an amazing experience to go along with all the others. And so that was part of an educational experience for you. What do you
say? It really was. And I think I'd just like to say people don't know that women and men are being held for months and years, some up to 4 years, because of the botched court system. They have not been tried. So you find many women awaiting trial or sentencing because just simply because these the draconian sentences, for one, out of the drug war time, and which still people are still paying for, and and all of this is rooted in the military-industrial complex, actually, which has provided a very narrow range of jobs and employment. And what are we having? 58% of the American federal budget going now into the military, whereas the next country, which I believe is Russia, spends about 27% of its national gross income on its military, and the United States is double that practically. So.
Let me, because we're running out of time, the final thing that I do want to ask you about, Sister Rice, is your message to young people. You're here at 86, just having served some serious time and having devoted your life to this kind of resistance of a war machine that does make it in large part impossible for us to feed our young, to take care of the schools that they need. One gets the feeling sometimes, based on the way that the education system is neglected and the whole scene there, that one gets the feeling that maybe we don't love our children. And I'm sort of wondering your relationship in this work, what you say to young people, and what part of sort of passing that on, what that means to you?
Well, it means that I can only be true to myself and to the way I was created and brought up by my parents, who were people who had clear social consciences and understood what we call the social gospel, the good news of humanity, of serving people in order to that life may be enhanced, and also to expose that which is destructive or unfair to life. So let them please pursue that which will enhance not only their own lives, but the lives of their children. And perhaps sometimes that means not looking for enjoyment, but looking for, well, peace and harmony and goodwill as the prior objective, and the values that lead to goodwill. And it also means exposing and opposing known crimes, knowing when one's government or anyone is can be creating a crime. So let them please be aware of their history lessons and the kind of history that they are being taught, because again, we are all prey to propaganda and miseducation. So I don't know if I'm saying too many things at once, but they will raise children according to the nonviolence of their own relationships and the loving relationships that they have with their children and the children with their parents.
Beautiful. Sister Megan Rice, peace activist, works with Transform Now. Plowshares served some 2 years or more in jail. Their sentences were finally overturned. I guess this is last year. What an honor to speak with you, Sister Rice. We wish you the best. And, please invite us in for your 87th birthday. We'd love to celebrate it with you.
I will hold you to that, Dennis.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right.
It's been a pleasure to meet you.
All right. Bye-bye now. Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Transitions on Traditions, a soul sonic rhapsody of words, sound, and power, where yesterday meets today and reaches towards tomorrow. I'm Greg Bridges, your host every Monday night from 8 to 10. Join me as we explore all that comes under the umbrella called jazz. From Lester Young to Lester Bowie, from Coleman Hawkins to Ornette Coleman, from Langston Hughes to Nikki Giovanni and beyond, Transitions on Traditions, Mondays 8 to 10 p.m. on listener-sponsored radio, KPFA.
And
This is 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz and online at kpfa.org. At 6 p.m. up next is the Pacific 8.